Republicans versus Republicans. Some members of the GOP file suit against the governor over early voting in Texas just 2.5 weeks away. That story and more today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. We'll hear what the lawsuit against the governor says about Republicans' confidence in the Texas general election. Also, do you trust the numbers? Texas teachers concerned about the spread of COVID are now crowdsourcing coronavirus information. We'll hear why. War of the Worlds. Microsoft takes on Texas in a high-stakes battle for gaming supremacy. Also, the Texan biking the 3,000-mile perimeter of the Lone Star State, and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Thursday, the 24th day of September, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. As we close in on early voting in the general election set to begin October 13th here in Texas, let me say that one more time, October 13th. We also note that something almost unthinkable only a few years ago has happened. The Republican National Committee has wired $1.3 million to the party's Texas outpost. It is what Politico calls the biggest transfer ever from the GOP mothership to the Texas State Party. Both parties, Democrat and Republican, are known to do such stuff in an election year, especially in battleground states. But the size of the contribution and where it's earmarked says something about how Republicans at the national level see their chances in Texas right now, much more as one of those battlegrounds than at any time in some 20 years or so. The polls show a tightening race between Joe Biden and President Donald Trump in Texas, but it's down ballot races that the party's most concerned about, it appears. Everything from a U.S. Senate contest more hotly contested than many had predicted earlier this year, and the possibility that coming off of Democratic gains in 2018, Texas Democrats could win enough seats in the state house to take back control of the lower chamber. It's against this backdrop that the Houston Chronicle reports something else that might have seemed somewhat unthinkable once upon a not-so-distant time. Some of Governor Abbott's fellow Republicans have filed suit against Governor Abbott to nullify an executive order, specifically the one that opened up early voting on October 13th, extending that early voting period by some 6 days. The Houston Chronicle's Taylor Goldenstein has been reporting this story. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Who's behind this lawsuit? Tell us more.
So this is one of many lawsuits filed by Dr. Stephen Hotze. He's an activist who has taken issue with Governor Abbott, you know, using his emergency powers to make coronavirus decisions.
Is it just Dr. Hotze, or are there more signed on to this lawsuit?
No, we're actually seeing six state lawmakers involved in the suit, senators and representatives, all Republicans. We're seeing Republican candidates at the Harris County Republican Party chair, Republican group leaders. It's a big coalition.
Why would he file suit, and why is there anything to the timing, for example? We're just, what, less than 20 days away from early voting?
Yes. Well, the suit is basically, it's pretty cut and dry about Texas state law defines when the early voting period is, and the period that Governor Abbott has delineated is not in that law, and they say he doesn't have the authority to suspend laws, only the legislature does.
Is this about separation of powers, gubernatorial authority, that sort of thing, or is this about concerns when it comes to election outcomes?
I mean, it could be a little bit of both, but as the lawmakers and the people carrying this legal procedure have said, it's really just about following the letter of the law on, you know, can the governor make these decisions, or should it be up to, you know, your elected officials, your lawmakers?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans and maybe onlookers on the other side of the aisle may wonder whether or not this is a kind of isolated incident. You mentioned that this individual who is leading this lawsuit is someone who has filed suit before. Or is this part of a broader debate among Texas Republicans about the direction of their party?
I would say so. I mean, as far as the specifics of whether his executive orders are legal, I think the opinions vary. But just this week, the SREC, the State Republican Executive Committee, voted and said that they wanted to see Abbott, rescind all of his orders and immediately let the state go back to normal business operations.
We should probably roll back the clock just a little bit. What's the origin story of this decision by the governor to expand the early voting period?
Sure. This is not the first time he's done this. He did this in the July primary runoffs as well. The thinking is, you know, if we give people more time to vote early in person, that means shorter lines, people not having to be around each other as much. And for a lot of people, it's been, you know, offered as an alternative to expanding mail-in voting, which Democrats have pushed for.
The idea being that under lockdown, or at least what was a much more severe lockdown, that voters would have more time to actually get to their polling places, and that this would mitigate problems, I guess, on the back end, right?
Right.
So is there any indication that this issue could be an issue when it comes to actually counting the vote, or that this could have an effect ultimately at the ballot box come Election Day?
Well, one of the other things that the executive order allowed was a longer time period for people to drop off their mail-in ballots in person to their early voting clerk. And this writ of mandamus that they filed asks for that period to only be Election Day, as the Texas election code sets out. So if that period were actually reduced, it's possible that, you know, a lot of people who had planned to use that method, you know, might have to rely on the mail system, which, as we know, may not be as reliable as it has been in past years.
Do you have any sense of how likely it might be that a judge would intervene and, in fact, nullify the executive order and we'd be back to the old timetable?
Well, with virtually all of these suits, Dr. Hotze has not been very successful at all. To this day, you know, no executive order has been overturned. So based on history, it's unlikely.
Make of that what you will. Taylor Goldenstein is an Austin-based state politics reporter for the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Taylor, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Of the more than a million public school students estimated to have returned to some form of on-campus activity at schools in Texas, just under 4,000 have tested positive for COVID-19. That's far less than many teachers and administrators feared. But are those numbers accurate? Zef Capo is the president of the Texas American Federation of Teachers and the Houston Federation of Teachers. Mr. Capo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Welcome. Happy to be here.
What do you make of this state data? Are you, in fact, encouraged by what you're hearing?
Well, you know, I'm certainly relieved that so far there has not been a significant breakout. I'm obviously deeply concerned about those who have contracted COVID and how that's happening, and want to stay on top of every single case that comes through. There's nothing that would make me happier than to be wrong about the deep concerns we've had for breakouts. But I think we're just, frankly, a bit too early. You know, not necessarily that the data is wrong, but I think that there are several aspects about our public school system, particularly in Texas right now, that I would still want us to be very cautious and continue to implement safety protocols with the highest level of degree, because I think that we aren't out of the woods yet.
I know of at least one school district in North Texas that was not going to publicly release its coronavirus numbers out of concern, I guess, for the possibility that some schools might be ordered closed. And there was a lot of concern about transparency, not just at the district level, but at the state level, too. And so your group now has created its own database of sorts. Tell us about it.
That's right. We do have a crowdsourced Texas public schools COVID database where teachers, school staff, parents, frankly, even high school students, others would be able to go on and report instances, not only of COVID cases that they've heard of in their particular schools, but as well to make safety reports, particularly if there are concerns about if their schools are receiving proper cleaning, or if they've received proper PPE to safeguard themselves and their students. Prevention is far more important to us in this particular case, and we want to make sure anybody who's returned or is required to return has everything they need to be as safe as possible.
Why did you feel the need to create this, and are you concerned about the accuracy given that it's crowdsourced information?
one of the reasons that we decided to do this is for exactly the reason that you mentioned. Some schools may not necessarily be publicly reporting, or school districts. Our state level data may be coming out by the district level, but may not necessarily come out at the campus level. We firmly believe that having that campus level data is going to be extremely important, because that's where our members, our teachers, make their decisions. That's where our families will be making their decisions. You really need to make sure that you are talking about neighborhoods, talking about communities that would have most of their direct interaction, and be able to get data sourced at that level. When these reports are made, they must provide some type of physical evidence, letters from their supervisor or their school district notifying them of a COVID case, perhaps a media report. Or if they don't have any of that, they've got to give extensive narrative details, and then we have to make a judgment call on whether we publicize that information or not.
How are you advising school districts on moving forward with this data?
We want to make sure that they're using it to improve their plans, and to make sure that they are ensuring that where we potentially see stop gaps, that they're filling those gaps, particularly with our safety reports.
Especially with so many districts yet to open, right?
That's exactly right. Hopefully, between our data and the state data, they'll actually be able to see what's working, what's not working, and give real-time recommendations to school districts.
Zef Caffo is president of the Texas chapter of the American Federation of Teachers and the Houston Federation of Teachers. We'll link to more over at texasstandard.org. Mr. Caffo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Thursday. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about our top story, that group of Texas Republicans suing over orders from GOP Governor Greg Abbott, baselessly alleging that expanded early voting will lead to voter fraud, which we should note remains exceedingly rare. On our Facebook page, Chris Bellinger says, "Why am I not surprised? One thing the Republican Party is good at is knowing the rules, finding the gray area, and exploiting it to their advantage." John Davis says that the issue for them is the governor making unilateral decisions they claim harm the state. John adds, if only they had this much backbone to call it out on the national level. And Brandy Whitman says, remember which politicians and representatives want fewer people voting. Write their names down for the next election. And speaking of elections, whoo boy, are we hearing from folks about President Trump's remarks refusing to commit to a peaceful transfer of power should he lose the White House in November, going on some 50 comments, at least right now, on the Texas Standard Facebook page. I'll be back with some of those and more from social media later in the program.
Indeed, we would love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Whole lot of news on this Thursday, and Wells Dunbar is keeping up with your reaction to it. He'll be joining us once again in about 35 minutes as the Texas Standard continues. Time check coming up on 19 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Surveys indicate military veterans tend to vote Republican, but earlier this month, The Atlantic published an article that may have given some of them pause. It claimed President Donald Trump had referred to members of the armed forces killed, captured, or shot down in battle as losers and suckers, something the president denies. In this general election year, how are Texas veterans feeling about the commander-in-chief? Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
Marilyn Harris says she was disheartened by Trump's alleged remarks.
As a person that served in the Army for 11 years and went to war, I am a Gulf War veteran. For this country, I believe in service. I believe in serving this country, and I want my president and the people of America to appreciate my service, because it was, in fact, a sacrifice.
Harris runs a nonprofit and stays publicly nonpartisan, so she declined to say who she'll choose for president. Other veterans I interviewed share her views on service, but as Brian Escobedo told me, that doesn't mean they're a unified voting bloc.
The veteran community is quite diverse in its political views. You'd be quite surprised to find out that we are just as diverse in our political views as the regular population.
Escobedo is the brother and cousin of U.S. Marines. He watched 9/11 unfold on a TV in his classroom when he was 16 years old.
And I decided that moment I was going to be a Marine. It wasn't any other branch. I said, not the Army, not the Navy, not the Air Force. I'm going to be a Marine. Now I'm going to go fight these guys who did this.
Escobedo enlisted a year later and served for 5 years, deploying to Iraq 3 times and earning the Purple Heart in 2007. I asked him if he knew how he planned to vote in the presidential election. He didn't answer directly, but said,
the veteran community is pretty split as far as for and against the current sitting president.
Harris and Escobedo are just two of the nearly 1.6 million veterans living in Texas. These are people who take their civic responsibilities, like voting, seriously. And many of them support President Trump. Like Army veteran Sean Ellis, who served in Somalia and Haiti. Ellis credits Trump with fixing the VA healthcare system, which saw scandals under Presidents George W. Bush and Obama.
I'm just happy to see in the last 4 years under this current administration that our healthcare is put back into a priority.
But not all vets look at Trump's healthcare record strictly through the lens of the VA system. Will Spencer Jr., who retired after 27 years in the Army, blames Trump for the coronavirus pandemic.
Back in February, he just chose to ignore it. And to me, as a leader, you those are things you just don't do.
He plans to vote for Vice President Joe Biden. So does Brian Wilson, an Iraq War vet and one-time combat medic. Wilson voted Libertarian in 2016, and before that, he voted a straight Republican ticket.
And it's been a long move away from the GOP to the Democrat Party for me, but I really think that a lot of the values that I have in my life have changed, and I've seen what the GOP has done recently in the past decade. It's just more or less reactive to any situation without planning ahead.
Wilson says it's important to him that the president have a well-organized cabinet with well-thought-out plans. Right now, he says, it's just chaos.
You know, one of the things that really bothers me about President Trump is the hubris that no one else can be smarter than him and that he always has to have the right answer. And that's not a good sign in leadership.
It's also worth remembering that President Trump made numerous remarks disparaging veterans during the 2016 campaign, particularly regarding the late Senator John McCain. Exit polls that year showed him carrying the veterans' vote by nearly 2-1. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The battle for supremacy among video game hardware makers sometimes feels like one of the epic titles you might play on the forthcoming Xbox X or PS5 consoles. One company outmaneuvers the other when taking pre-orders. Another buys up game studios to make its platform more compelling to players. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to help us understand what's actually going on in the world of console gaming. Omar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, David.
Let's get to the Texas Nexus here because it's a biggie. Microsoft has acquired a Texas-based game studio. Tell us about that.
They have actually acquired 8 gaming studios under the umbrella of a company called ZeniMax Media. And they are not a household name, but the studios that they own and the games that they put out are very, very well known. We're talking about Bethesda Softworks, which makes Elder Scrolls and Fallout and Wolfenstein, id Software, the famous Dallas-based company that made Doom and Quake, and here in Austin, Arkane Studios, which makes Prey and Dishonored. I mean, these are very big franchises among gamers. And the deal was for $7.5 billion, which, to put it in perspective, my friend Britton Peel at the Dallas Morning News said it's basically like when Disney bought Marvel and Lucasfilm combined. That's how much money they're spending. A lot of titles and a lot of studios under this umbrella. It's huge.
And we should point out that Bethesda joins another important studio, Obsidian, as part of Microsoft. Those two companies make games in the same genre. Is one likely to lose out when they're both under the Microsoft umbrella?
It depends. They're both working on some very big fantasy games, you know, the next edition of Elder Scrolls. But one thing people are kind of excited about is Obsidian could bring back the Fallout Vegas franchise, which people love. And John Carmack, who used to be at id Software, mm-hmm. could return to the fold. He actually tweeted something saying, oh, yeah, this sounds like a good idea. Maybe I should revisit some of my old titles. And John Carmack famously was the co-creator of the Doom and Quake games at id Software. So he may be coming back to those titles again after having left under weird, you know, kind of acrimonious circumstances.
Well, let's pull back from the games and look at the industry writ large. Microsoft and Sony each have new consoles coming this year, but the battle between them, as I understand it, isn't just about features. Tell us more about the launch and pre-order strategies of Microsoft and Sony.
Yeah, the two new game console series are launching within 2 days of each other. The PlayStation 5 launches on November 12th. The Xbox Series X launches on November 10th. They're both in the kind of $500 range. There are different editions of it. And it's not just about this is better hardware, better graphics. It's also just each company is really trying to position itself as we have these exclusive games. We have these games that you really want to play that you're not going to get on the other console. And that's really what the ZeniMax deal is about. It's Microsoft saying, sure, those games might still be on the PlayStation 5 for the next year or so. But after that, we're going to have a lock on those games.
Well, I guess maybe you've answered this question, but before this Microsoft news, Sony's PlayStation 5 was getting a lot of attention, I guess in part because it was a platform for some of these games.
Yeah, and also they've kind of botched the pre-order launch for these consoles. I mean, these consoles will probably be very hard to find once they actually debut, so there's been a big rush to pre-order them among the gamers that can afford it. And the PlayStation 5 pre-order launch did not go well. Some retailers jumped the gun a day early, and gamers were very unhappy that they were not able to get their pre-orders in. And Microsoft had some of the same issues with their pre-order, so it was pretty ugly.
Not pretty. You have a dog in this fight, Omar, either a favorite console or a game you're excited about that's coming out soon?
You know, I skipped the entire last generation of Xbox. I was a big fan of the Xbox 360, but I never got into the Xbox One, and I've stuck with PlayStation 4. But Microsoft is making some big moves here, and I'm a big fan of their Game Pass, which kind of combines PC gaming and Xbox console gaming. I mean, there's some really great games on the Xbox Game Pass, like Flight Simulator, the whole Ori series is wonderful and beautiful, Sea of Thieves. I mean, there's some great games on there that you can get for $1 a month for your first month, and then it goes up to, I think, $5 or $10. I'm not sure if I'm going to buy either one or both. I'm still kind of waiting to see how that plays out.
But I'm
definitely a fan of the games that they're putting out. There are some really great titles out.
Of course, it's not all just fun and games. It's big business, too. And Omar Gayaga covers it over at TechMinuteTexas.com. Omar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David. Always happy to talk about games.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The number of workers in Texas seeking new unemployment benefits last week fell to its lowest level since the onset of the coronavirus pandemic in March. The U.S. Labor Department reports today roughly 47,000 Texans filed initial unemployment claims during the week ending September 19th. That's down slightly from the week before. Some Texas nursing homes will allow visitors into residence rooms starting today. TPR's Bonnie Petrie reports.
People who live at approved nursing homes and other state-supported long-term care facilities can now choose two people to visit them in their rooms. No physical distancing. The visitors will be trained in the use of personal protective equipment and other measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus and will only be allowed in rooms one visitor at a time. Another change, residents in nursing homes with active COVID cases will now also be able to visit with family and friends in designated coronavirus-free rooms through plexiglass barriers, as well as share physically distanced outdoor visits. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
People across the country marched in the streets Wednesday to protest the decision to indict only one of the three Louisville, Kentucky police officers who shot and killed Breonna Taylor in a botched drug raid. That includes hundreds of demonstrators in Dallas who gathered outside of City Hall hours after the grand jury decision. A second group protested in front of Dallas Police Headquarters and then marched to City Hall, where they demanded justice as the city council voted on a new budget.
We're going to remind him what the people's budget is.
Yeah.
We're going to make sure that he understands that we want justice.
The Dallas City Council approved a new budget last night that left police funding intact, despite calls from residents and activists to make significant cuts. Death row inmate will now serve life in prison after the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals changed his sentence because of his intellectual disability. Wednesday's decision makes Gilmar Guevara the seventh person in the state to have his death sentence commuted since 2017. That's when the U.S. Supreme Court ordered Texas to change how it determines whether someone has an intellectual disability, which would make them ineligible for the death penalty. Kristen Huley-Cuellar is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. She points out the inmates remained on death row for many years before their sentences were changed.
These seven people, on average, spent more than 26 years on death row.
I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Newsroom.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Throughout the pandemic, we've been getting your questions answered and soliciting advice related to the coronavirus from Dr. Fred Campbell. He is a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's good to be with you, David.
So we're going to start today by trying to get some clarification on instructions from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. There's been some confusing guidance from the CDC of late regarding how the virus spreads through the air. The agency posted on Friday that the coronavirus, and I want to quote here, could spread through airborne transmission between people more than 6 feet apart, then removed that guidance on Monday. So what is the most up-to-date information on this, Doctor?
It's very fortunate that there has been a recent extensive review published in the Annals of Internal Medicine on infectivity with COVID-19. So I can feel pretty comfortable about these recommendations, as opposed to an emphasis on aerosol particles, which are the ones that spread widely. Mm-hmm. It appears that that is a very unusual way of transmitting COVID-19, with rare exceptions. There was a choir church situation where it might have happened, but otherwise, the 6 foot distance is still considered to be an extremely effective recommendation.
The likelihood that you're going to get an infection from such a scenario is extremely rare, even though there might have been one instance of it that's medically recognized. Is that right?
That is correct. Those aerosols do contain virus particles, but for whatever reason, they don't appear to be infectious.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Now, let's move on to the next question, which comes to us from an anonymous listener who asks, is it clear how HVAC systems influence COVID particle movement in an enclosed environment, like a school? In other words, if a carrier is breathing out particles in one room, can they be transported to a different room through the building's air ducts? What do you say?
There has been a lot of discussion, particularly in airline travel, mm-hmm. about the idea of filtering and recycling air. To my knowledge, there have been absolutely zero studies to talk about infectivity with those kinds of situations. And the HVAC, although it could very well move particles around, particularly the aerosolized particles, again, as we spoke about earlier, I think that the infectivity rate among the studies that have been looked at have been extremely low with that kind of transmission.
So extremely low liability that you're going to catch COVID because of someone in a different room and particles going through the air ducts. Extremely low possibility.
I think that the data supports that completely.
In Austin, listener Michael has this question. We know that it's much harder to spread the virus outdoors than inside. That's what the experts say. But what about, here's another scenario, in a garage with the door open, is that a suitable environment for small gatherings, or is it just as bad as being inside a structure, to your opinion?
No, I do not believe it is as bad as being indoors. Ventilation is extremely important in an enclosed space, and a garage would be as close to an outside environment as one could get. So a large ventilation like a garage door would provide a significant amount of protection. Of course, has to be coupled with the 6 foot social distancing and wearing of the mask, but that would be a preferred situation to an indoor closed up environment.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that because, you know, I've noticed, and maybe you've seen this too, I've noticed like small, what appear to be sort of, I don't want to say block parties, but it appears like neighbors gathering outside a friend's house just to have that human touch, right? And they're sitting in lawn chairs, maybe outside a garage or partially inside a garage. How risky is that sort of thing?
Well, we're again talking about percentages. Nothing is 100%, but the review of the studies having to do with outdoor activities leads to an incredibly low infectivity rate among virtually all of the studies that I've looked at.
So on balance, we should feel pretty safe about those situations so long as we're maintaining social distance. Should we still use our masks? Do we need to still use our masks in that sort of thing?
With the exception of long periods very close together outside or not wearing masks, otherwise people can feel really comfortable about those outdoor distancing events.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine over at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health, San Antonio. We have been having him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. And so if you have something you would like us to ask the good doctor, you can look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for your advice. We certainly do appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. From Heel to Toe is our segment wherein Texans talk about their boots. And today, it's a Texas-sized tail, a size 96 to be exact.
My name is Katie Sauceda. I'm from Keller, Texas, and I am the 2019 Big Tex Boot Design Contest winner. The State Fair of Texas and the KC hosted a contest for anyone to submit a drawing of what they wanted Big Tex to wear. As soon as I saw the contest, ideas were flowing through my mind. So the first idea that popped in my mind was the Alamo. And that was an easy one since I'm from San Antonio. Like, we were constantly going to the Alamo for school trips. And then me and my husband, we do a lot of hiking and camping. So one of our trips was out to the Davis Mountains out in West Texas. The mountains that I drew on the boots, that's from one of those trips. And then the bats that are flying out of the oil derrick. I used to live in Austin. And so on some sunsets, we would go down to South Congress Bridge and watch the bats fly out from underneath it. So each symbol that I drew on the boots, I have like some connection to. Yellow Rose, Texas, because I'm from Texas. I'm jalapenos because I can't get enough of them. I was also like trying to think, well, if I was a tourist, like, what pops into their mind? So it's like the Alamo, Armadillo, Cowboys, the Blue Bonnets, all the ropes. So I'm trying to think from that perspective as well. So I actually came across the contest last minute. I only had a week to come up with something, design it, and submit it. Towards the end, yeah, I was just losing motivation. And I just remember looking over at my baby while he was sleeping. I was like, you know, how cool would it be if I actually won this? You know, like, I need to finish this for him because he's going to grow up and say, like, wow, my mom designed those boots. So I submitted my design with, like, a day to spare. So I had to pay extra postage to make sure that they got it on time to stay fair. There are over 250 entries. Technically, it was open nationwide, not just statewide, so anyone could submit anything. The results came in, and I was at work at the time, and I just wanted to scream so loud, but I couldn't because I was at work. And at the same time, I had to keep quiet until it was officially announced that I was the winner. And that was probably the hardest secret that I had to keep just because I was so excited. I mean, I hugged the boots, and my arms wouldn't wrap around them. Big Tex wore a size 96 boot. He has a big foot, and I thought I had one. So, yeah, he totally beats me. Enjoy seeing his boots because they do look really awesome in person.
That's Katie Sauceda, winner of the 2019 Big Tex Boot Design Contest. Big Tex has two other pairs of boots, but you could say that Sauceda's are the fanciest by far. The State Fair of Texas begins tomorrow this year in drive-through only mode. Visitors have to wear face masks too, but they can get out of their cars at Big Tex Plaza and even remove those face masks to pose next to Big Tex himself as he rocks Sauceda's boots. Got a boot story? Send us a note, texasstandard@kut.org. If you take I-10 from Orange to El Paso all the way across Texas, that's about, 850 miles or so. From the bottom of the Rio Grande Valley to the top of the Panhandle, that's roughly the same distance. That's a long ways for sure, but it's nowhere close to going all the way around Texas. Tracing the perimeter of the Lone Star State will take you an entire 3,046 miles. That's not a number we had at our fingertips, mind you, but one we got from Aaron Chamberlain. And the reason he knows it? Is because he's doing all of it on a bike. Chamberlain is a cyclist and a production director at Texas Monthly, and he joins us now on The Standard. Aaron, where are you right now?
I am about 20 miles south of Shamrock, Texas.
You're going to have to put us on a map there. Where is Shamrock, Texas?
That is in the Panhandle, actually.
Wow.
So I'm beginning my trip north into the Panhandle.
Where have you been so far? How long have you been on the road?
This is my 23rd day on the road. So I left September 1st out of Brownsville.
So I went up
the coast to Texarkana, and then I turned left and head west to Childress, and now I've turned north and heading to Shamrock today.
Before we get to why you're doing this trip, what have you seen along the way? Anything that surprised you? I mean, I know you work for Texas Monthly, so you know a lot about Texas to begin with.
Yeah, I have seen a lot of Texas so far, but I feel like not much of it at all. I went up the coast. That was really nice. I spent time with my family, and they got to go to a beach every day as I rode. And then once I got into the Piney region of Texas, East Texas, I've never been to before. Uh-huh. So that was kind of a surprising place for me. More hilly than I thought it was going to be, actually. I guess the best part is seeing parts of Texas I haven't seen, but also the people along the way who have helped out. I stayed at a family's house in the backyard in a pop-up camper, and I just met them through Strava, which is a cycling app. And then I've had people come out and ride with me. There's a couple guys that came out and rode with me from Marshall to Texarkana, and that was kind of a long day. It was 75 miles, so I was thankful to have them with me during that long ride.
This is a kind of fantasy trip for a lot of people who are hardcore bicyclists, especially from Texas. What made you decide to go on this trip?
Yeah, it is. Last year I was riding my bike on every single street in Austin, actually. So every street you see on a map, I've ridden in Austin. And when I was finishing that project, I guess you call it, I was thinking, what should I do next? And the idea of just riding around the entire perimeter of the state came to me, and it seemed like a possible thing if I could just find the time to do it.
And what made it possible? The pandemic, or was your boss willing to go along so long as you did some riding from the road?
A little bit of both. You know, when the pandemic hit, I kind of thought, well, this will have to wait until 2021, 2022. But then things kind of just stayed the same. We're all working from home. And I said, well, maybe now is actually the best time to do it. I can still socially distance myself, and I could still do work that needed to get done. With work, I also asked if I could add some content along the way with the ride, and that seemed to work out well.
Yeah. So what's the next leg looking like for you?
The next leg is basically I'm focused on the Panhandle. So I'll head up north to the top, turn west, and then come back down south. And that should be about, I don't know, a week, I think, a week and a half. So this time next week, I should be up and around, I think.
And when do you think you'll conclude this epic journey?
Let's see, I think it's 55 or 56 days of actual riding and with a few rest days in there. So I'm planning to be done by October 29th, which is my wife's birthday. So I told her when I was taking this trip that I would be back for her birthday. So that's kind of a deadline.
You're going to have to pedal hard.
Yeah, that's true.
Aaron Chamberlain is a production designer for Texas Monthly and a cyclist currently biking the perimeter of Texas. We'll link to some content over at Texas Monthly so you can keep up with his journey. Aaron, thanks so much for your time and stay safe out there.
Thanks a lot.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Residents living in one part of downtown Fort Worth are not likely to see their 67th birthdays. Researchers at the University of Texas Southwestern found last year people living in Fort Worth's 76104 neighborhoods have the lowest life expectancy of any other zip code in the state of Texas. A Fort Worth Star-Telegram investigation published this week looked into several factors community leaders and public health officials say are contributing to that low life expectancy. Nicole Manna is a reporter behind this investigation, and she joins us now. Nicole, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, what are some of the characteristics of this zip code? Could you tell us a little bit about the geographics, demographics, the economics of this area?
Yeah, so this zip code is south of Fort Worth's downtown, and it includes the historic Southside, Hillside, and Morningside neighborhoods, which are east to I-35W. It also includes Fort Worth's Medical District, which is just to the west of the highway. And it's an historically Black area, and the neighborhoods have been pretty neglected for the last several decades. And a lot of people living there live below the poverty line, and a lot of the others are just getting by.
I think when you hear things like people living below the poverty line in concentrated areas, one would immediately think, well, that's got to be a factor that plays a role in the community's lower life expectancy. And yet you have a medical district right there, too. Could you say more about why these numbers are so astonishing?
So I talked to a lot of public health experts who, you know, all said that poverty plays a huge role in your health. It really comes down to what is called the social determinants of health. We're talking about income, access to healthy foods, insurance, safe places to exercise, educational opportunities, racial segregation, unemployment, safe housing. And yes, you're right. The hospital district is right there. And a lot of these hospitals have programs and opportunities to help people without insurance or to help low-income people. But there seems to be this kind of disconnect between the hospitals and the people living there. 5,000 people that live in that area don't have insurance. So they had, you know, the people I talked to had no idea, you know, that there was help. And even if there is, it still is too expensive for some people. One of the hospitals told me about a mobile care unit that can help check your heart health, but it's about $75 to $100 for that test. And for a lot of people, that can mean not feeding their family for a week.
Did anything stand out to you when it came to a particular leading cause of death contributing to this low life expectancy, or is it just varying issues?
It's a lot of varying issues, but the number one cause of death was natural causes, with heart disease being the number one like source of death. So people there are dying from the nation's number one killer, but they're dying 12 years before the national average.
Any sense of how, say, COVID-19 might be affecting this area, or is that information included in this data?
It's not included in the data from UT Southwestern because the study predates COVID-19, but we looked into it, and a lot of the data is still missing. But we did find that 76104 as a whole is one of the harder hits area of Fort Worth. And some of the people that I talked to said, you know, they don't know if their neighbors have COVID or how it's personally affecting the people around them because there's such a stigma that comes with it. So people aren't talking about if they got sick. A lot of people aren't getting tested because they probably can't afford to, and they don't realize that there are free options out there.
So, Nicole, what are community leaders and public health experts saying that they're doing to try to address this low life expectancy in this zip code area?
It's hard to say. I hope to follow up with our community leaders, especially to see their reaction, to see what they want to do. The city is trying to redevelop the Evans and Rosedale corridor of 76104. And so far, nothing has happened. But from what I've heard, they are in the final steps of figuring out the redevelopment plan. I spoke with somebody at John Peter Smith Hospital, which is Tarrant County's only public hospital. And he said that there's a clinic just north of 76104, and it could be in walking distance for about half of the area, but it mostly serves people who are experiencing homelessness. So a lot of people who live in those neighborhoods don't go to that clinic because there's kind of a stigma with going there. And he plans to do some boots on the ground work to talk to people in the neighborhoods and reassure them and tell them that clinic is there for them too.
Nicole Manna is an investigative reporter with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Nicole, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he's been monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Thursday, as he is wont to do. Hello
there,
Wells.
As I am. Hi, David. Good to be with you. As I mentioned earlier, President Trump's remarks for refusing to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, essentially, causing huge waves on social media. This was at the White House yesterday, where basically he said, we'll have to wait and see, and called into question what he's been referring to as a surplus of ballots floating around out there. Very vague language from the president, and words that are obviously stirring lots of comments and condemnation on social media. This one message on our Facebook page from Linda Pallett seems reflective of some of those condemnations. She writes, President Trump is making plans for losing the election and stealing it in any way, whether through disallowing mail-in ballots or using the Supreme Court, obviously referring to that new vacancy on the Supreme Court. Jonah Blackley says, whatever your political preference, he calls it a bait question and an ill-considered answer. He adds, if the scenario actually did arise, and there's a lot of if between here and there, then President Trump could have little choice in the matter. And President, of course, not without his supporters, Jana Wilburn Reed. She cites a conservative writer who said that she was embarrassed for anyone who would defend that idiotic question from the reporter. I believe the terms were like win, lose, or draw. Do you commit to a peaceful transfer of power after the election? Mm-hmm. So obviously, yeah, this story not going anywhere. Got to say, there was this blockbuster report in The Atlantic yesterday, too, that I think really set a lot of folks on edge talking about a lot of these similar issues. What would it look like sort of gaming it out? Should the election be thrown into chaos and the president essentially declare himself the winner? So lots of consternation out there, David.
Consternation and a lot of theories about what might happen. I read somewhere that the Democrats are already lawyering up and trying to game this out themselves. At the national level, should in fact something like there be some discrepancies on the day of or day after the general election and thereafter. I note that Senator leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky tweeted out something after the uproar over the president's comments. He says, the winner of the November 3rd election will be inaugurated on January 20th. There will be an orderly transition just as there has been every 4 years since 1792.
Right. And, you know, so, I would just note that some folks taking note with that, even with that language, saying the November 3rd election winner. So obviously, does that include ballots that could be counted after the fact?
I see
speaking of that election, I don't know if you've seen this, David. Lots new polling information. This new New York Times Siena College poll, including Texas voters, looks like Donald Trump leading by 3, John Cornyn at 43%, MJ Hager 37%. So lots of information there to pore over.
Indeed. And the news continues over at texasstandard.org, and it continues right here on your public radio station once again tomorrow. We hope you will join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.